Christian, there are times when we point people to Christ. And as a result of our witnessing, a process of conviction begins. And things don't get better at first, they get worse. And we must be ready to go to those people. And the only solid answer we have for their hurts is to tell them again who He is.
Welcome to Behold Your God Radio, featuring Dr. John Snyder, the teacher from the multimedia Bible study, Behold Your God, Rethinking God Biblically. I'm your host, Matthew Robinson. If God is real, and we call ourselves followers of God, how should that affect our lives? What's the proper response to knowing the living God? Today, John begins a new series of messages from the book of Exodus. It will help us to answer those questions. Let's listen.
We begin our look at the book of Exodus. We've come to this book not merely to see the rescue of God's people, but to see the God behind the rescue. And to ask ourselves this question, how does a people live with a living God? Israel has so much to learn if they're to live with a living God. 400 years of captivity in Egypt has required them to be reacquainted with the God of their fathers. Certainly, they have a nominal knowledge of the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But sadly, the evidence of their activities in the book of Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy demonstrates that their views of God were deformed and contaminated by long contact with Egyptian idolatry. So God teaches His people by various means that He is unlike any other person they've ever met. He uses ceremonies, sermons, rules, laws, commands, but alongside all of these, we have a series of concrete events that reinforce the lessons that they're learning. In reality, Moses needed these lessons as well. Now, I think that when the believer looks back at the book of Exodus, this is a great benefit for us because most of us grew up hearing a lot about God. And we had the right name. We said the word God. We said the word Jesus Christ. But oftentimes, our understanding of the God of the Bible has been fashioned or deformed by our contact with cultural religion. So in being rescued from our old life, we too need to learn the lessons that Israel needed to learn. Every Christian being brought out of sin's dark tomb, freed from the enslavement to self, needs to learn certain things if they are going to walk with the living God. And one of those lessons is that we need to learn how to get the question right. Now, let's go back to Exodus 3. Moses meets God at the burning bush and receives His commission. And I want us to think about some of those things that happened to Moses there and the questions he asks and how they apply to Christianity today. The first thing we want to consider is the task. The task that Moses is given is astonishing in its proportions. He is to lead hundreds of thousands of Jewish slaves out from the Egyptian Empire. They've been there for nearly four centuries. Egypt is one of the great world empires. The Jews have no armies, no money, no clever plans, and no outside help. If we think of another rescue in the Old Testament, our mind might go to the release from Babylonian captivity that comes so much later in Israelite history. But if we look at the final verses of 2 Chronicles chapter 36, we read these words, "Thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, the Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and He has appointed me to build Him a house in Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Whoever there is among you of all His people, may the Lord his God be with him, and let him go up." It's amazing that in rescuing His people from Babylon, God raises up a pagan king to be their friend. But in the book of Exodus, Pharaoh has no such intentions. Not only must Israel escape the physical borders of Egypt and enter into the new land of Canaan, but they must also escape the spiritual contamination of Egyptian idolatry, and they must enter into an entirely new way of living. From this point forward, Israel will be distinguished by the fact that this people belongs to a living God. Now, on top of all these aspects of the task, we see that Moses does not have what it takes. Already, he's attempted to rescue the Jews on his own strength. Moses saw an Egyptian beating an Israelite. Moses, in anger, killed the Egyptian. But it didn't do the Jews much good. All that occurred as a result of that was that Moses had to flee Egypt, and now for 40 years, he's been exiled to the wilderness. But after 40 years of isolation, in Exodus chapter 3, Moses is about to meet the God of his fathers. He's going to receive his commission, and he's going to learn his first lesson. The lesson is this: you need to ask the right question. Now let's stop and think as Christians about this whole matter. The Christian life parallels this. We have to leave the old life behind, the old way of thinking, of desiring, of choosing. We enter into an entirely new life with the living God. The old life was lived under a tyrant that was much worse than Pharaoh. And the new life requires much more than the Exodus event required. The difference between the old life and the new life for a Christian is so dramatic, it's described as a new birth, a new creation, and a spiritual resurrection. I want us to stop and think of a couple of things related to the Christian's task. Moses was given a task, but so is every Christian. The task that every Christian has is summarized in the little command of Jesus Christ: follow me. Now, nothing could be simpler and nothing could be more inclusive than this phrase. What does it mean to follow someone? Well, it's much more than knowing about them. It's much more even than admiring them. It means that there is a very concentrated focus on what they do, and there is a responsiveness, an imitation. If we follow a person, when they turn right, we turn right. When they stop, we stop. When they go faster, we go faster. There is a constant focus on that person. There is a shutting out of all others, and then there is that responsiveness of our heart and mind and will. We want to imitate them. It's so simple. Follow Christ. Every Christian is a follower. But it's also an all-inclusive command. The task that we've been given is that each and every Christian must be a follower, and every area of life must be affected by this activity of following. Every stage of life, young, middle-aged, elderly, every Christian is to be a follower throughout all their life. In a marriage, a husband is to follow Jesus Christ, and that means he is to love his bride like Christ loved the church. When we come home from work, we are to lay down our rights, our preferences, our comforts for the good of our wife. Wives are to love their husbands in a way that reflects following Christ. In the same way the church trusts and loves and submits to Christ, the wife mirrors that in the way that she trusts and submits to her husband. Children are to obey their parents in a way that reflects that they're following the Lord's pattern, in the way that Christ obeyed his Father. Parents are to steward their children. We are to raise them in a way that reflects the way the Father would raise us. Paul even says that workers are not to do anything at work merely to please their bosses, but rather they are to do all to please God. Every area of life is affected by following: how we eat, how we drink, how we get dressed, how we cultivate friendships, how we respond to those who are our enemies. Everything is included in this activity of following. Paul says it this way in 2 Corinthians 5, "The love of Christ controls us. Having concluded this, that one died for all, therefore all died, and he died for all, so that they who live might no longer live for themselves, but for him who died and rose again on their behalf. What a wonderful picture for the believer. Paul is constrained by love to take the task of following Jesus of Nazareth seriously. But there's a second thing about our task. It's not merely that we are to be followers, that we are to be conformed into Christ's image. It's that we are to do that as a part of a greater company, a part of a family or a body. Like Moses, for the Christian to finish the task that God has given him or her, they cannot merely obey God as an individual. If Moses would have, after Exodus chapter 3, gone home and explained the situation to his wife and children, and they were to have packed up and traveled to Canaan on their own, they would not have been obedient. Moses was required to do more than go to Canaan. He was required to bring a great company of people with him. The Christian has an obligation in this task. God has assigned the Christian the responsibility not only of being an individual follower, but of helping every other believer to follow Christ as well. Paul says in Colossians 1, "We proclaim him, admonishing every man and teaching every man with all wisdom, so that we may present every man complete in Christ." For this purpose, he says, I labor, striving according to his or God's power, which mightily works within me. Now, in case we are ready to raise the excuse that we're not apostles, we're not all even preachers or missionaries, remember what Paul says to every common Christian in Ephesus. In the small epistle to the Ephesians, chapter 4, Paul talks about the risen and ascended Christ giving through his Spirit spiritual gifts to his people. And then we read this, that the purpose for these gifts is the equipping of the saints for the work of service, to the building up of the body of Christ, until we all attain to the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God, to a mature man, to the measure of the stature which belongs to the fullness of Christ. Do we hear that? And on top of all of this task, like Moses, the Christian realizes that we don't have what it takes. We are not capable of fixing ourselves. We are not capable of fixing our families. We're not capable of fixing our churches. And we're not capable of fixing our nation. We have proven this 1,000 times. Like Moses, we've failed so often that perhaps we would think that with regard to us, God will let us off the hook, that he will say to us that we're on the B team, and that he doesn't really expect us to take these commands to follow Christ and to build each other up seriously. We need to be honest. If all you're intending to do is to add religion to a life that's already pretty full, you don't really need God. And you're not going to be plagued by any serious and deep questions. But when the Christian realizes that God is serious about the command to follow Jesus Christ in every aspect of life, and that there is no other option available, no other person will do it for us, and there is no other path open to us, then from the heart of the Christian, a question is wrung. We're not talking about the kind of questions that we ask when we're merely curious. We want to know the answer to a certain sticky passage. We want to know what the book of Revelation means in these strange pictures. Not that kind of curiosity, not that kind of question, but the kind of question that goes much deeper. The kind of question that comes when we really feel the weight of God's commands. And that's what we see in the life of Moses. When Moses faces the task squarely in Exodus chapter 3, he has two great questions. And the first question he asks is this, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and that I should bring the sons of Israel out of Egypt?" That's in verse 11. Who am I? Now, it's good to ask this question. It's right to be honest about our inabilities. It's wrong to think that we can fix the problem and that whatever God asks us to do, if you'll just give us a little time, we'll make him proud. But when God tells Moses, "I will be with you," that question must be set aside. It's a natural question when God gives us a task that we feel inadequate for, but it is the wrong question nonetheless. It is based on the false idea in Moses that his abilities are at the heart of this equation. Later in chapter 4, we find an example of this working itself out in a specific argument with God. Moses says to God that he can't be the spokesman. God needs to choose someone else because Moses is not a good speaker. And God's answer to that is that he has created men's mouths. In other words, it's not the ability of Moses to speak, but the God who is commanding Moses to speak that is at the heart of this equation. But Moses carries on arguing, and God is offended. The root of this question in Moses, "Who am I?" is offensive to God because Moses is not the hope. God is. And so Moses' inadequacies, they don't even figure into the equation. In fact, it shows that Moses has a small view of God. If Moses saw the immensity of this person, the infinite and incomprehensible and incomparable bigness of God, he would forget his smallness. He would forget this question. Does Moses think so little of God's wisdom as to think that perhaps God has made a mistake? Does Moses think so little of God's strength as to think that perhaps God needs a bigger tool? Now, Christian, God has told us through his Son that he would be with us until the end. So when you see the commands in the New Testament, do you still look within each time the command comes? And when you take it seriously and the weight behind that command begins to be felt, and you feel overwhelmed with the task, do you look within and say to God, "God, who do you think I am that you would give me this kind of a command?" You think about it. You look at your home and you consider the commands of God for you with regard to your family. And we ask God, "Who am I?" We look at our workplace and we think of God's commands for us as witnesses in the workplace. And we ask God, "Who am I?" We look at the church and we ask him, "Who am I?" Sometimes perhaps we think that God is mistaken. We think that he's forgotten who he's dealing with. Perhaps his wisdom isn't so great as we thought it was. Maybe God means for other Christians to live like this, but I'm a special case. I have so many struggles. I have such a hard situation that surely God doesn't expect me to do this. And so we turn to God day after day in little ways, in unspoken ways. We pull back from obedience. And our question to God is this: "Do you really know who I am? I don't think you can expect me to follow Christ all the way." Perhaps we doubt God's strength. We think that he needs really strong Christians. The truth is, we do need to come to an end of our self-confidence. We are full of this illusion that if God only gives us another chance, and if only we try hard enough, and we have enough passion, then we can accomplish what needs to be accomplished for the pleasure of God. But the reality is that no amount of willpower will ever rescue you from those plaguing temptations. And no clever scheme and no new book or conference will in any way rescue your family. No set of rules, no doctrines, no passion can fix what needs to be fixed. So we must quit asking the questions, "God, who am I to do this?" The roots of our questions are as wrong as the roots were of Moses' question. You think that you're the center of all of this? You think that your inadequacies are going to affect God's calculation? No, we need to back up with Moses And we need to change our question so that we can see God for who he really is. And in seeing God, we know that the better question is, who are you? Now, as Moses continues in chapter 3, we find him saying to God, when I go to this group of people and they ask me, which God sent you? What do you want me to say to them? That's a good question. God, who are you? Who should I tell them sent me? Now, for the Christian, this is the question we have to ask ourselves every morning. When I wake up in the morning and all of the doubts and the fears and the struggles of sin are in front of me, and my heart is shaken by the thought of what's to come, and the fantasy that I'm sufficient for this has been stripped away by so many failures, and I'm tempted to turn to God and say, God, who am I? Then I need, like Moses, to come back to God and say, I have another question for you, God. If you say that you're going to be with your people even to the end of the age, then who are you? And Christian, we spend the rest of our life hearing the answer to that question. And each day we step out in obedience. Now, this is a question that needs to be asked not only for the benefit of the individual, but also for the people that we're trying to help. In Exodus chapter 5, when Pharaoh is confronted by Moses, he becomes angry and he tells the foremen who are over the Jewish slaves that they are to remove the straw that they were providing for the Jews. The Jews will have to make bricks, but they have to make it without provision of straw. So they have to get up earlier and stay up later. They have to gather the straw and then make the bricks without making one less brick. Now the people of Israel, of course, have become despondent because instead of being rescued by Moses' message to Pharaoh, it seems that life has gotten much more difficult. And in chapter 6, Moses goes to them with the answer to their complaints. And in verses 1 through 8, he gives a description of God. It's the same kind of description we find in chapter 3. But after that wonderful description, after Moses answers the question, who is this God who will be with us? Sadly, we read in verse 9 that the response of the people is that they will not listen to Moses on account of their despondency and of the cruel bondage. Christian, there are times when we point people to Christ, and as a result of our witnessing, a process of conviction begins, and things don't get better at first, they get worse. And we must be ready to go to those people, and the only solid answer we have for their hurts is to tell them again who he is. And when we come alongside of a Christian that's struggling, and it seems like it would be so much easier if we let them compromise, we must come to them with the same things Moses came to Israel with. We must come to them again with a description of the God that they walk with. Who are you is the most significant question that we can ask.
We're so glad you joined us today. This series, Living with a Living God, will continue next time here on Behold Your God Radio. If you've been helped by the messages from Dr. Snyder, keep in mind you can listen, download, and share them with your friends on Facebook and Twitter at beholdyourgod.org. It's also where you can discover more about the DVD study, Behold Your God, Rethinking God Biblically. The website again is beholdyourgod.org.
What is preaching? Logic on fire.
When you met with him and talked with him, you left his presence feeling a greater hunger for God and to know Christ.
I refer to Martin Lloyd-Jones as maybe the last of the Puritans.
Logic on Fire, the life and legacy of Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones, a special edition documentary DVD set of the life and ministry of one of the greatest preachers of the 20th century.
He was a man trained to be a medical doctor who felt the call of the Lord to be a surgeon of souls.
Although he was an intellectual, He put the hay down low where the sheep could reach it.
He was grave in the pulpit and urgent about the souls of people listening.
This is a deluxe 3-DVD documentary collection with cloth-bound book from American Family Studios and Media Gratier. Available at afastore.net.
We ought to ask questions of the Bible like, who is God? How can I know him better?
When we really let Scripture speak for itself, then it always brings us into the presence of God.
The Bible is about God. It is about his story. It is about him making himself known.
How would rethinking God biblically affect the way we approach our Bibles?
Dr. John Snyder, author and host of Behold Your God, Rethinking God Biblically.
As we begin to understand the greatness of God, this incomparable book will no longer be treated as a medicine cabinet in which we find a pill to get us through the day. And we'll quit searching its pages merely to find answers for ourselves, our families, our nation. But instead, we will see it as the personal unveiling of God and come to it to meet with him.
Visit beholdyourgod.org.